I guess the last stage, which is, it's a series of three cases. And it's stage, he has these, pardon? Yes, I have to tell you, I've been forgetful. At each session, I have managed to do one other thing wrong. I always do this. So, have I missed? Okay, I did okay.
That's
good.
The section of us to keep track.
Let's start over. Let's start over.
You want to start again? We can take a vote on that. But we will be starting again. All right. 97-0676, 97-0685, 97-1109. State B. Hezzy, R. State B. A. State B. Ryan, B. L. Appearing on behalf of the defendants here are Eileen A. Hirsch, Assistant State Public Defender. She'll be representing all three.
I should say that with me at counsel table are Mikey Ogilvis, who represented Luis H. in the Court of Appeals, still does. And just behind Mike are Stacey Walker and Deborah Flynn-Torino, who represent Hezzy R. But I'm the one who's talking today, and maybe I'll need help, too. In November of 1996, Ryan was adjudicated delinquent on two counts of second-degree sexual assault. His custody was transferred to the Department of Corrections. He was placed at Lincoln Hill School, where he remains today. Next month, when the Department of Corrections opens a new adult prison in Racine, Ryan will be eligible to transfer to that prison. His corrections placement can continue until June of the year 2000. Before he's released from corrections, he will be evaluated for possible commitment under the Sexually Violent Persons Act. And when he is released from corrections, he will be required to register for the next 15 years as a sexual offender. Much of his registration information will be widely available to the public. Whoever testifies in a court hearing, his juvenile delinquency adjudication can be used to impeach his testimony, and he can never own a firearm. Hezzy and Luis have not yet been tried in juvenile court. They are here on an interlocutory appeal. However, if they are convicted of the offenses with which they are charged, adjudicated delinquent of the offenses with which they are charged, they will be subject to all of the consequences, both the immediate disposition and the long-term consequences with which Ryan is facing now. In addition, Hezzy, because of his age and his crime, will be eligible for a five-year commitment, a set-term commitment to the Department of Corrections under the Serious Juvenile Offender Act. There, he can be administratively transferred between juvenile correctional institutions, community placement. And when he reaches the age 17, he can also be placed in an adult prison, any adult prison. When he's 17, under the Serious Juvenile Offender Act.
How old are these three right now?
Ryan is 15 now, so he's eligible for that placement. Hezzy and Luis are 13 and 14. We have four separate constitutional bases for our claims that Section 938.31, parens 2 of the statute, which denies jury trials in delinquency cases, is unconstitutional. Due process under both the federal and state constitutions, equal protection under the federal and state constitutions, Article 1, Section 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which provides the right to jury trial in all criminal prosecutions, and Article 1, Section 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution, providing a right to jury trial in all cases at law. I think the first question before the court is, what is the effect today of McKeever versus Pennsylvania, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and this court's decision in In Re N.E.? Our position is that the analysis, the fundamental fairness due process analysis, which was used in those cases, is the analysis the court can use today with regard to the due process claim. We believe that if the McKeever court were faced with the current law in Wisconsin, the current state of the juvenile delinquency court in Wisconsin, that it would find that Section 938.31, parens 2, is unconstitutional because it does not provide fundamental fairness.
Now, does that mean, counsel, that the legislature would have to, if they wanted to, if the court were to go your way and say that there would be no trial unless it's a jury trial, would that mean they could not change the juvenile justice code, or they just change it a little bit? How much could they have changed this code and still have the question of the jury trial being handled by the two cases that you mentioned? What is the line that you're asking this court to draw?
The courts in other states have struggled with that. As you know, there's a case in Washington about whether placement in an adult prison is over the line. Another case about whether making it a strike offense for a three-strike law is over the line. I can't tell you exactly where to draw the line today. I don't think this case is even close because we have punitive consequences. We have the long-term consequences, the consequences that reach into adulthood, which was clearly one of the demarcations in McKeever. And we have a very fundamental shift in the intent and purposes of this juvenile justice code. And I think when you put all of those together, the totality of those circumstances, that where that line is drawn is somewhere clearly on the other side, that we've crossed the line so far that it's not a close case about if we just did adult prisons and we didn't change the intent, would that make a difference? I can't really tell you that analysis.
Ms. Hirsch, let me, if I might, ask you about the serious offender provisions of the code. What triggers those? What does a young person have to do to be within the framework of the serious offender provision?
They have to be 14 years old, and they have to have committed a serious crime. There's a specific list of serious crimes in Section 93834. I can't tell you what the list is. There's about 10 or 12 crimes. They're mostly Class B felonies and more.
So they would be crimes carrying up to 40 years or possibly life, depending on what.
Yes, there's a separate provision. I talked about the Class B felonies that Kezi and Luis are charged with. The Class A felonies, the life imprisonment felonies, are also under the Serious Juvenile Offender Act, and they have a commitment to the Department of Corrections for up to age 25, with all of the same provisions of the transfer between the various facilities.
Now, when the legislature amended the code and moved it to 938, is that when the serious offender provisions came into play? In other words, was it part of the same process?
My understanding, yes, that it was part of the same process. There were a few things that went into effect 6 months before, 6 months later, but I'm fairly sure the serious juvenile offender was actually part of the juvenile justice code.
Can you tell me, are you arguing that every juvenile charged with a delinquent act would be entitled to a jury trial, that the whole code would have to provide jury trials, or is it those kinds of cases that implicate some of the considerations you gave us, in terms of potential incarceration in adult prison, the sexual predator, you know, the other ones?
Well, it's a very complicated question because we have these four constitutional theories. Under the fundamental due process analysis, I think the court has the ability to draw lines in different places. In fact, in our brief in the Court of Appeals, we suggested that any juvenile who can be placed in the Department of Corrections under the fundamental due process, that's where we suggest drawing the line, that those children are entitled to a jury trial. However, we have also put forth the theory under Article 1, Section 7, that this has become a criminal code. And under that analysis, it would be all juveniles charged with delinquency. Also under equal protection analysis, it would be all juveniles charged with delinquency. So it depends a little bit on which theory the court wishes to take.
And even if you take a theory such as that would give you the opportunity to divide out the juvenile, the legislature did not do that. Didn't they just eliminate
the
trials for everything?
Right.
So if we were going to divide out, we'd have to write in, do a trial by jury for the following.
Right. We would. I guess it would be a finding that the law that denies the right to jury trial or took it away is unconstitutional with regard to these categories of juveniles.
And we would rewrite it then to provide jury trial.
I guess the legislature might eventually rewrite it to comport with your decision, but yes.
Or we could just strike down the whole law because we don't know what their intent was.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that their intent really was to create a criminal code, and for that reason, we would suggest that all juveniles, just as all adult criminals, have a right to a jury trial in Wisconsin. And that would be a good constitutional theory, and that would end the applicability of that entire law.
Counsel, when you read the preamble of 93801, it seems to me that you could take the view that you're espousing that it's a criminal code, but if, in having been a juvenile judge for 13 years prior to coming on the court, that when you read through the various sections when they talk about to respond to a juvenile offender's needs for care and treatment consistent with the prevention of delinquency, each juvenile's best interest in protection of the public by allowing the judge to utilize the most effective dispositional option, it seems to me that that sounds a great deal different than a criminal code. It seems that there still are paramount interests as far as individualizing that for the juvenile and talking about the rehabilitation, which they do in the adult court, but talking about the prevention of delinquency, et cetera. So if maybe you can respond to that, because it seems that they did retain a great deal of the former code.
They did retain sections of the former code, but they have clearly set forth, and in the first part of the section 938.01 that I refer to as in parents 2. And in that they say, and they explain this in an article, they say that we have now a balanced approach to the juvenile justice system. And the balance is the rehabilitation of the child, the protection of the public, and direct accountability for their criminal acts. Our belief is that that's exactly the same balance that occurs in the adult system. If you look at the McCleary factors for sentencing, the court is directed to look at protection of the public, the seriousness of the offense, which is direct accountability for the offense, and the character of the offender, which of course deals with rehabilitation and likelihood of success in some sort of system. The old parents, the difference is what you said there is the paramount consideration. The old parents patriae children's code, the juvenile justice code, was unbalanced. We did not have a balanced system before. It was directly on the best interest. The paramount consideration was the best interest of the child. That's been taken away in this new code. And now they provide balance. And we contend it's the same balance that exists in the criminal system.
Counsel, you started your comment on the McIver case, and you suggested under the federal due process analysis that the McIver court is faced with situations of today rather than 27 years ago would hold differently. The McIver opinion, as I read it, and I know it's a fractured opinion, but looking at the plurality, it seems to me that it focuses more on keeping a bright line distinction between the adult criminal system and the juvenile system. They're reticent to adopt a jury trial right. They didn't adopt a jury trial right because they said that's going to get us back to an adult system. We don't want to get and have the trappings of an adult system. So it seems to me that your statement that they suggest that they were focusing on the, you know, remedial or the punitive or those kinds of concerns didn't exist in the plurality opinion to the extent that their concern was bright line with juveniles, and adults. Can you respond to that?
I agree with you, and I even think it goes further in that decision. What they say in that decision is they want to keep the unique nature of the juvenile code, the intimate, informal hearings of the juvenile code. And if you remember, back at the beginning of the juvenile justice system, the idea of a juvenile court was that it wouldn't be held in chambers like this. It would be held in the judge's office with just a judge, the child, the parents, and a probation officer, a social worker. And I think they still had that ideal in the time of McIver or McIver. And one of the reasons I don't think McIver would apply in Wisconsin today is we do not have an intimate, informal process at our adjudicatory hearing, and we haven't had one for as long as I can remember. Every juvenile court hearing, at least for the last 20 years, has a judge on the bench, the court reporter and the clerk in their places. They have counsel at counsel tables. Witnesses are sworn. The rules of evidence are followed. What they were concerned about in McIver is Booth is going into an adversary kind of hearing. That's what we have. We do not have now a state interest in having an intimate, informal adjudicatory hearing. We don't. It simply is no longer the state's interest to keep that as it was in McIver. And so, at this point, how a jury affects the nature of the juvenile court proceeding in Wisconsin is hard to say. You can't see a difference. In fact, we've had jury trials in juvenile court proceedings for 70 years. And so what they were trying to keep, what they were putting forth as a state interest in McIver, doesn't exist in Wisconsin. We just don't have that kind of hearing.
Let me ask you a follow-up on Justice Bradley's question. McIver, as I understand it, comes after Gault.
Yes, about 5 years after Gault.
My recollection is that Gault is the place where the U.S. Supreme Court said, we've got to have a more formalized system. We've got to have confrontation, cross-examination, right to counsel, sworn testimony. So the system changed with Gault, didn't it?
That's true. But I, you know what I think happened in these series of cases, there was Kent, Gault, Winship, Shriver. And I think what happened is, you know, this system had existed for 65 years, 66 years before Gault. They make this major change in golf. A few years later, McIver comes up, and they don't know yet what impact these changes are having in the juvenile law. In fact, in Wisconsin, until 1978, we did not have prosecutors in juvenile court. It was not required by state law until 7 years after McIver. So what they were saying is, we don't know what impact these changes are having. We are concerned that maybe we're going too far, that maybe we will change the nature of these hearings. And what we have now in 1998, 27 years later, is we have changed the nature of these hearings. They are adversarial hearings, and there is no longer a state interest in this intimate, you know, meeting in the judge's chambers. The other point I would mention is intimacy is one of the things in the Tyler cases. It's one of the words they use. And this juvenile justice code actually opens up the juvenile court much more to the public and the press than was previously done. So in terms of whether we want our courts to be intimate, the legislature on one hand is saying, no, we don't. We'll bring in the public and the press.
What should state due process argue? Because there may be some reticence to attempt to modify U.S. Supreme Court cases.
Right. Well, I want to mention, though, that the analysis used in the U.S. Supreme Court very clearly is an analysis that depends on the individual facts of a situation. And our view is the facts are completely different now than they were 27 years ago in the McIver case. And even under a federal due process claim, you wouldn't be violating the precedent of McIver by finding that this law is unconstitutional. In terms of the state due process claim, again, I think that the state uses much the same balancing process, but I think it may be appropriate to use the state constitution because it is a state system, as the Attorney General pointed out in this case. But we basically would argue the same analysis under the state constitution. I would note that the state constitution does allow for greater protection of rights than the Wisconsin constitution, and there's some Supreme Court decisions on that, too. We are looking at 1-7 rather than 1-5. Our criminal claim is 1-7. We also have a claim about 1-5. I think it's related very closely to our other decisions. I think the court probably knows, the 1-5 is interesting because it goes back to the 150 years ago at the time of the Wisconsin Constitution. Cases at law is the applicable word. And our view of that is that I think the history is fairly clear. At law, juveniles charged with serious crimes, basically felonies, were tried as adults at the time of the Wisconsin Constitution in 1848. And it wasn't until 1925 that they were brought into the juvenile court system. Now, courts have, in some cases, have held that juvenile court system then is separate and not a case at law. But when felons were brought into the juvenile court system in 1925, children charged with felonies, there was given at that point a statutory right to a jury trial. And so our argument is that basically from the beginning of the Constitution, from 1848 until 1996, when this new Juvenile Justice Act took effect, that juveniles charged with felonies in whatever court have always had a right to a jury trial. And so that it's more historic, and that these really are cases of law. It's also related to, of course, to being criminal cases. They become cases of law.
So what happened to, in the interest of any, and if they were entitled to a jury trial, this court said, I believe, in 85 and 86, under the 78 code, that there was no right to a jury trial. Now, the argument that I hear, well, now the code has changed, and therefore, in the interest of any, it's not applicable. But this court and some of the members on this court indicated that was the decision 13 years ago, which was the code that the changes that I see would be added accountability, community safety, but retain, that's what I was asking in the first place, the other goals of the juvenile code.
There's sort of two questions, and I want to get to your second one, too. First one is true. NE was based basically, largely, on the McIver decision,
right.
We have no argument with that. As far as Article 1, Section 5, we do disagree somewhat with the discussion in the NE decision, although part of our argument, too, is that the juvenile court system created basically an exemption or an exception to the cases of law, right to a jury trial, and that it's become so criminal now that exception should no longer exist. But I want to get to your second point, which is about this rehabilitation argument, and I think it's important. If you look at, I'll try to find in my notes here, basically, we use this general phrase of rehabilitation, I think, to mean a lot of things. And I think that there are two different kinds of rehabilitation in the old Parents Patriae Children's Code and in the current Juvenile Justice Code. The current Juvenile Justice Code, the section on rehabilitation is 2C, which is to provide an individualized assessment of a delinquent juveniles to prevent further delinquent behavior through the development of competencies so that they can live productively in the community. That rehabilitation argument, that statement of rehabilitation, is really a public protection kind of rehabilitation. If you look at...
So doesn't the public protection take place in 2A to protect the citizens from juvenile crime?
Yes, it takes place both places, absolutely. If you go back to the old Chapter 48, the rehabilitation argument was a parental rehabilitation argument. Remember, this was a parents patriae system. And that was that one was 1B, to provide for the care, protection, and wholesome mental and physical development of children, preserving the unity of the family when possible. That's what they called rehabilitation. To me, that's what parents want for their children. This was a parents patriae code. The rehabilitation that's now in the juvenile justice system is like the criminal justice system rehabilitation. We want to rehabilitate people so that when they get out of prison, they're not going to be dangerous to society. I just have a few minutes left, and I want to just mention briefly our equal protection argument. And the equal protection argument, is very interesting because...
How do you differentiate between Article 1, Section 5, and Section 7, and which is a stronger argument?
I think the criminal argument is our stronger argument, Article 1, Section 7. That analysis is the Hendricks versus Kansas analysis, the Leighton Art School analysis. If you go through that, what was the legislative intent of this code? Where is it placed in the statute? Moved out of Chapter 48, it's moved into Chapter 938, right next to the criminal code. The intent has become like the criminal intent. The dispositions are putting people in prison. There are these long-term criminal consequences. That's our criminal argument. This has become a criminal code. In fact, even the language has changed. They are no longer children. Now, if we are a parents patriae system, how do these people stop being children? They're juveniles because they're young law offenders. And so I think our stronger argument is Article 1, Section 7, but it's a criminal code.
Is there due process under Article 1, Section 1? That's what I understood it to be. So you're arguing 1-1, 1-5, and 1-7. 1-5 is the civil, 1-7 is the criminal, but your due process is under 1-1.
That's correct.
And the title is under what? Sixth Amendment?
14th Amendment.
Yeah, but
through the
But the fundamental fairness argument. They use the general. They do not incorporate the first 10 amendments of the Constitution.
And NE is both 1-5, and then on page 203, it has a paragraph on your state due process, which is really under 1-1.
That's correct.
We don't have a federal interpretation of what in a criminal prosecution when you need jury trial.
Correct.
Article 1, Section 7
relies on the Wisconsin jury trial criminal act.
Can NE be distinguished?
I don't think NE needs to be distinguished. I mean, NE, I think, is like McKeever. NE was in 1985.
That's
before
what
the,
I meant.
Yes. Based upon the past. Yes. It's the same analysis, different circumstances. And when you do that, it's clearly a new case in front of this court using that analysis. Yes.
One of the differences I saw in NE was that it relied in its due process on the Scholl case. And Scholl was talking not about keeping this distinct system of juveniles and the distinct system of criminals, but rather let's look at the nature of what's really happening. That's what Scholl emphasized. So I see a difference in approach.
Between McKeever and NE?
Yes, because of its reliance on Scholl.
I think you're right. Scholl, of course, was before juveniles charged with serious crimes were in the juvenile court system, so they were really dealing with incorrigible, neglected, wayward children in Scholl. But I think that McKeever may have focused a little more on we don't want this to be a criminal system, but the balancing is the same, and maybe the Wisconsin Supreme Court did it better in NE by looking at the real nature of the proceedings and what kind of interests are at stake and really weighing that. But the reliance on Scholl was certainly a good reliance, but you have to remember Scholl did not then involve any serious crimes or any incarceration in prison. So it's a different fact situation.
Equal protection.
Thank you. I just want to say, if you do not believe, and you decide that none of our arguments that this is a punitive code are correct, the state says this is not a punitive code, this is still the good old parents patriae juvenile justice system we have always known, and that children in this system are deprived of their liberty for purposes of care, treatment, and protection, then we believe that these children are similarly situated to children under Chapter 48, Chapter 51, Chapter 55, and Chapter 980, all of whom have a right to a jury trial under their statute. And so whether this is punitive or whether this is for care and treatment under the Equal Protection Clause, they have that right.
We're using strict scrutiny rather than the rational basis test for the Equal Protection Clause.
That's correct. We say under either analysis that there is no rational basis, not even a rational basis for that distinction.
I'm going to give you a chance to hit a home run.
I thought you were telling me to sit down.
To me, as I read the briefs here, the whole question was, well, how close is this to being a criminal code as opposed to maybe a movement away from parents patriae, but not far enough away to invoke the constitutional remedy? Ms. Posselet is going to stand up here in a couple of minutes and is going to argue just that. And I would like you to sum up for us, so that the rest of what you said in the brief, I still have to read again. Why is this a criminal code, or at least so close to it, that it deserves, that the juvenile prosecutor under it deserves a fundamental right?
I guess, you know, the short, funny answer that comes to my head is it's Chapter 938, which is right next to Chapter 939. That's one reason. But I think that the fact that they're no longer children, the fact that that the intent and purpose is balanced like the criminal justice system, the fact that these children who are sent to corrections can end up in an adult prison next to adult prisoners, and the fact that they have these long-term, perhaps lifelong consequences, criminal consequences, coming out of these adjudications of delinquency, when you put those together, that's as close to a criminal system as I can imagine.
Now, in your introductory comment, you added penalties, and I was going to ask you then if you meant a penalty of punitive, or is that your summary of all of these?
That's pretty much, that's a summary of both the actual imprisonment and the long-term consequences.
Thank you, Ms. Kirsch. Gregory Posner-Weber, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, I am Greg Posner-Weber. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin. I represent the state as the petitioner in Hesse and as respondent in Luis and Ryan. With me at council table is Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman. I have all these great notes. And I'm going to throw them out and come directly to Justice Adler's question because I think that's the focal point of today's argument. We have a juvenile justice system and we have a separate criminal justice system. The juvenile justice system does not end in a criminal conviction of any delinquency adjudication. That's the first major distinction between a criminal code and a juvenile justice code. The second, and I think more profound distinction, is in the dispositional alternatives that are available to a juvenile court judge in fashioning, crafting an appropriate disposition for a child who's adjudicated delinquent. Counsel speaks of the elements that a circuit judge must consider in imposing sentence, the McCleary elements, and plainly those apply in criminal proceedings. In juvenile court proceedings, in section 938.34, where you find, I want to say at least a dozen, I'm sure it's more than that, various dispositional alternatives that are available to the juvenile court judge to meet the needs of an individual child found to be delinquent, distinguishes the juvenile justice system from the criminal justice system. If it is not enough that a juvenile adjudicated delinquent does not carry a criminal conviction, a criminal record with him or her through life, then certainly the dispositional distinction the distinction between the dispositional alternatives that are available in a Chapter 938 proceeding versus the sentences that can be imposed in a criminal proceeding is enough to distinguish the two for purposes of due process analysis and for purposes of the Sixth Amendment and Article 1, Section 7 analysis.
They look persuasive, but let's just look at what your alternatives are. One, counseling. Can't an adult prisoner under conditions of probation have to get counseling?
After imposition of the criminal conviction, yes, but I think the counseling that's contemplated in the juvenile code is counseling judge speaking to child. I don't think it's
counsel the juvenile or the parent guardian. Don't
right.
It's the judge.
I think it's the judge.
Does the judge ever counsel a person who's been criminally convicted? Better behave yourself. You need to behave. You either obey the rules of parole or probation, or you're coming back here. You better do it in good faith. Okay, supervision. Place the juvenile under the supervision of an agency department or adult, including a friend. It's a little different, but you place the criminal convicted person under the supervision of an agency.
It's significantly different if the placement is an out-of-home placement in the community as opposed to the prison system and the criminal system. But yes, there are some similarities.
Volunteers and probation program. Is that one that was developed for adults?
Originally, yes.
So it still is an effective system.
Yes.
Volunteers and probation for an adult and teen court program. Now that's different.
That is
What about intensive supervision? That's the 2 hours. Court of the juvenile to participate in intensive supervision under 938-534. Is that like the intensive supervision that adults get? I'm just going down your
list. I understand. I don't know with that particular disposition. One of the... I don't want to interrupt. We're going to keep going.
Well, I was just going to go down. Then we got placement, and I assume that might be something like the department might place an adult who is on probation in any of these places. It's a lot different because you've got the child caring institution and you're the program, but it's placement.
One of the significant distinctions, I can cut to the chase for the sake of
time. You better cut to the chase because we've got, I'm now in three pages of this.
Much of what a juvenile court judge can order, can specifically order for an individual, a sentencing judge could not order. The programming of an individual who's committed to the prison system is arranged through the Department of Corrections, therapy, programming, education, all arranged through the criminal system through corrections. The juvenile court reserves to itself authority to order things like medical or psychological treatment or care or counseling. Reserves to itself the authority to order participation in individual programs. Reserves to itself the right to bug individual cases, to bring them back for review at some set point. These, I think, distinguish what a juvenile judge can do at a dispositional hearing from what a sentencing judge can do at sentencing. A juvenile judge has tremendous control over the individual aspects of a delinquent's life.
You would agree, would you not, that we are, this new system is closer to criminal proceedings than it used to.
I would agree with that.
And there are aspects of it, some of which were raised during the argument, that get very close.
There are aspects of the juvenile justice code that track individual aspects of the criminal code.
In particular, the fact that a juvenile might be placed in adult prison after becoming an adult, but under the juvenile code.
The serious juvenile offender commitment is probably that portion of the juvenile justice code that's most similar to the criminal code, at least insofar as the comparison of disposition.
But yet it's the state's position that even those juveniles who may be placed in a state prison with adult prisoners who had a right to a jury trial, that they are not in the constitution entitled to a jury trial.
That's our position.
Counsel, let me follow up on that if I might. How do you handle the Louisiana Supreme Court decision that was brought to our attention? My understanding is that's a decision within the last month or so. That decision, as I understand it, centered on the idea that because a juvenile could be placed in adult prison, that now there had to be the right to a jury trial. How do you distinguish that?
I can distinguish it, at least initially, by the fact that they proceeded under the Louisiana Constitution as opposed to the U.S. Constitution. There's a second provision, a specific provision in the Louisiana Constitution that speaks to the question of individual juvenile rights and responsibilities. We don't have language like that in the Wisconsin Constitution. Beyond that, the reasoning that was employed by the Louisiana court certainly tracks the position that the public defender has taken through the litigation. I do not know, in the context of serious juvenile offender commitments, how what the individual does in the system, how that compares with the hard labor provisions of the Louisiana system. The impression that I got was that hard labor meant precisely what they said, hard labor. The programming in the Wisconsin prison system is probably different. I do not know for sure. If the court feels it's a decision issue, I will do more research. The parties can brief the differences if necessary.
Let me ask you about framework here. I heard you arguing in part that you're saying that the code doesn't have enough indicia of a criminal code in order to rise to the level of requiring jury commitment. A couple of things I've heard you mention are that it's not a criminal code, and the second one that I heard you mention is that the judge has a lot more alternatives available to him or her at the time of the sentencing. What is it that the court ought to be looking at to make that determination? Other than it being called a criminal code and being just saying all juveniles are into the adult system, we have one system. I mean, I think everybody would agree that we don't have an issue. But short of that, what is the analysis that it has to undergo to make that determination?
First and foremost, I think a reviewing court has to look for a definitive statement of legislative intent, and we do not have one here. We have the Juvenile Justice Study Committee's report, a blueprint for change. And I think both the public defender and the attorney general agree that the legislature appears to have responded to those recommendations in great detail in formulating Chapter 938. There is nothing that expressly indicates legislative intent.
You assume it's get tough on juvenile crime in part, at least?
I think the legislature was trying to do three things. I think the legislature was trying to hold juvenile offenders more accountable for their actions. I think that the legislature was trying to enable juveniles, create a system that would enable juveniles to become productive, responsible citizens, productive, responsible adults, and they were trying to develop a system that would ensure community safety.
Well, Mr. I may be wrong in my understanding of the law, so let me say this to you somewhere. If a juvenile, let's say a 14-year-old, commits a sexual assault, under this law, they are not entitled to a jury trial. But if adjudicated delinquent, they can be subjected to registering, having to register for 15 years as a sexual offender, and possibly, at the end of their sentence, be committed under Chapter 980 as a sexual offender. Is that correct?
That's possible.
But if that same offense is committed by an adult, someone 18 years of age or older, before any of that can attach, that adult has a right to a jury trial.
That's correct.
Now, that to me looks, talks, smells like adult criminal code, consequences. Why is that not criminal consequences?
Some of the disabilities that attach to a criminal conviction attach to a juvenile adjudication of delinquency. I think the one specific one that does not is that there's no voting disability. No voting disability that attaches to a juvenile adjudication.
But they can't bear a firearm.
They are able.
You would agree that these are very serious consequences.
Yes.
15 years registration, possibly life confinement under Chapter 98.
They are very serious consequences. They are consequences that are directed specifically to the antisocial behavior, the acts that, if committed by an adult, would be criminal, that trigger the possibility of serious juvenile offender disposition. As I say, the distinction, when you compare SJO with the criminal alternative, the distinction that to me seems the most valid is the fact that these disabilities in the juvenile context do not stem from a criminal conviction.
Yes,
an individual goes through life having been adjudicated delinquent but not having been found to be guilty of a felony.
But the juvenile certainly feels the same way as an adult. I mean, feels the same way to the juvenile as it does to an adult, right?
The individual. The disabilities are the same. The perception, the juvenile's perception may well be the same.
Mr. Posner-Weber, let me ask you this. If you've got a sex predator allegation in regard to a juvenile, does the juvenile then have the right to a jury trial before being committed as a sex predator?
In the Chapter 980 proceedings, I believe he would, yes.
He can't re-adjudicate the delinquency issue.
Not in the context of the Chapter 980 proceedings.
I'd like to accept that you don't know what the legislative intent and purpose is. And 938.01 is entitled Legislative Intent and Purpose. And it says that the code 938 should be liberally construed in accordance with the objective expressed in this section. The intent of the legislature is to promote a juvenile justice system capable of dealing with the problem of juvenile delinquency, a system which will protect the community, impose accountability for violations of law, and equip juvenile offenders with competencies to live responsibly and productively. To effectuate this intent, the legislature declares the following to be equally important purposes of this chapter. A. Protect citizens from juvenile crime. That's a funny word.
Not the word that I would choose, no. It's not consistent with the position that has traditionally been taken.
But it's equally important.
Let me see those shoes.
B, to hold each juvenile offender directly accountable for his or her act. You know, I don't deny that all those are good purposes, and that's not what the issue is before the court, whether we like this or not. The issue is whether, if this is what the legislature is doing, constitutionally they have to give the jury trial, right? C, to provide an individualized assessment of each delinquent, etc. D, to provide due process. So the legislature wants to provide due process to each juvenile offender, and all other interested parties are assured fair hearings during which constitutional and other legal rights are recognized in the court. So the legislature understood that. To divert juveniles, F, to respond to juvenile offenders' needs, and G, which is another interesting provision, I think, to ensure that victims and witnesses of acts committed by juveniles that result in proceedings under this chapter are consistent with this chapter. The same rights of victims and witnesses of crimes committed by the child defendant use the word crime and are treated with dignity. So what you're saying is the victims and witnesses have the same rights in the juvenile court as they do in the adult system.
I think that's correct. I think it's directed not to turn the juvenile justice code into a criminal code, but simply to recognize the fact that if you are mugged by a 14-year-old, you are just as mugged as you would be if you were mugged by a 24 or a 34-year-old.
And the court is saying if you're a 14-year-old mugger under this law, aren't you treated the same as a 34-year-old mugger? Isn't that what the legislature intended? Now, I say treated the same, but there are differences. But the consequences are severe. We don't have to have exactly the same treatment of each criminal provision.
I think the legislature recognized that juvenile offenses, juvenile crime, if you prefer, was a serious problem, problem worthy of its attention, a problem that was not being adequately dealt with under the delinquency provisions of Chapter 48. I think the legislature, certainly the Juvenile Justice Study Committee, considered the question of fundamental fairness and more specifically what process is due. When we talk about due process issues, we're talking about what process is due. And in the context of the juvenile proceedings, traditionally the process that has been due in states other than Wisconsin has been a hearing before a fair and impartial judge. And we talked about this in the state's brief in chief. The ultimate goal, as I read McKeever, is to make sure that the juvenile system does two things. One, it guarantees that a juvenile doesn't have a biased or eccentric or unfair decision maker and judge. And second, there have to be protections against overzealous prosecution. As we discussed in our brief in chief, the system now does have those protections. There's a body of case law, both state and federal, that talks of an individual's right, non-specific to juvenile or adult, an individual's right to a fair trial. Juveniles do possess a limited right of substitution by demand. They always have the right to request recusal based on unfair treatment or refusal is required by law. There are the constitutional checks on a prosecutor's performance. If a prosecutor proceeds in an unfair manner, the juvenile can invoke the various statutory procedures, both in 938 and some parallels through case law extended to juveniles from the criminal code, the right to challenge the admissibility of evidence, pretrial motion practice, that type of thing. I think the public defender and the attorney general disagree on the question of whether fundamental fairness requires a jury to be the decision maker. And you were laughing at me before. I want to answer your questions now. Wouldn't miss the opportunity, Justice Bradley.
Okay. You're talking about fundamental fairness and due process and fair hearing. One of the things that bothers me, why is it fundamentally fair? Why is it due process fair hearing for an adult in a property damage claim? $100 fine is the consequence. And in the adult system, it is a fair hearing under due process to have a jury trial for that kind of thing. Criminal trespass event, property, just criminal trespass. You get a $200 fine, but you have a full jury trial. You've defined a fair hearing, due process hearing, fundamental hearing, as a jury trial. Here, you have your opposing counsel say that these juveniles will be 1 to 3.5 years, and one juvenile, 1 to 3.5 years confined, can go to an adult prison up to age 25, subject to possible indefinite commitment under 980. 15 years are required to register a sex offender. But for that kind of consequence, you don't need a jury trial to be a fair hearing under due process. It's just in touch with imbalance. Can you help me balance that out? It doesn't make sense to me.
I can help you balance it out. As I read McKeever and the due process cases that talk about the ideals of the juvenile justice system, I think that everyone who was associated with the process believed that there was some benefit to be derived by putting the fact-finding authority in the hands of an individual judge. In McKeever, they spoke of the great ideal of the juvenile justice system, which was basically a counseling parens patriae, the government as substitute parent, as an ideal. And McKeever said, we even have questions about that now, but we think that it is the state's prerogative and the state's alternative to decide if they are going to offer juries in these situations or in some juvenile court situations but not others. And there's language, I think, in the plurality opinion in McKeever that speaks directly to the state's authority to develop a system that works within this general mandate of fundamental fairness. And I've read my opponent's briefs very closely, and I've read the case law that's cited, and I don't see anything in it to suggest that juveniles who have a single judge as a fact finder are somehow being denied what is entitled to them by due process, a fair hearing, a fair adjudication. I think if anything, the argument that the public defender has made on brief is that somehow the constitutional right to due process entitles you to a better opportunity to not be found delinquent. And that's not what due process is all about. Due process implies fundamentally fair treatment by the fact finder. And I have not seen anything, read anything, heard anything anecdotally or quantifiably to suggest that fundamental fairness, a fair hearing, somehow cannot be had by an individual judge. The state of Wisconsin chose at one point to offer juveniles an alternative of a jury in a delinquency proceeding, and they have decided not to do that now. They have decided basically to join. The microphone went off. They have decided basically to join the majority of states that do not provide trial by jury.
question. So that was my question. That maybe this was in your briefs and I missed it, but the majority of other states, as I understand it, never had or do not now have the provision for jury trials and similar matters, given the matters.
There's a lengthy footnote in the TM case from Colorado that distinguishes that describes which states do and don't. In fairness, I think the public defender and I would agree that some states provide juvenile options for some types of delinquency adjudication, for some types of offenses. So I won't say that the majority provide absolutely no jury.
My follow-up question is, we discussed this with the opposing counsel about is there any way to distinguish constitutionally for allowing a jury trial in serious offender. The serious offender provision you're talking about vis-a-vis the other juveniles that fall under this code. Would this court be able to make that difference? That's what's proposed or thought about. It troubles me that we would have difficulty doing this.
Yes, in fairness, no, you could not do that and not take a principled approach to the public defender's argument, which also includes equal protection. Frankly, I think the state constitutional arguments probably are not of import in this litigation. This court has consistently told litigants that if they're going to argue a state constitutional ground in support of a claim of error, that there has to be some indication that the state constitution provided for greater protection than the federal constitution. The case that's coming to my mind is Pitch at 124 with second, the discussion of ineffective assistance of counsel where there were separate state and federal claims raised. I know this court has in the past entertained the possibility of finding greater constitutional protections under the state constitution. I don't see, again, in briefing or in argument, any indication that your right to equal protection or your right to due process is any greater under the state constitution. You could do that. You could do that. I still think, though, you'd have to get to equal protection.
Look, even if we got to equal protection, there wouldn't be a violation of the compels for the defendant. It would not be a violation of the federal constitution.
No, you could uphold on the state constitutional grounds.
Let me ask you about I've heard this several times from you talking about criminal conviction. That's one of the lines you got, criminal conviction. And at least historically, under the old code, the juvenile proceeding, for the most part, was closed so that the public wouldn't have access to know who the offenders that the juveniles were. Although there was some use of those convictions and adult criminals, of course, later on, those bad information is basically not accepted in the public if someone has been found delinquent or not. And some of the arguments that the appellants are making here seem to be that in fact there's some opening up of the juvenile proceedings now, that there is potential use of that delinquency finding as impeachment as an adult, and then all these other collateral things and not just collateral like sexual cutter, but that we've talked about. What's important about whether it is a conviction or whether it's a delinquency finding if some of the use of that, whatever it is the same? I mean, why do you keep saying, well, one, it's not a conviction? I mean, you've identified the right to vote.
I say it's not a conviction because it isn't a conviction.
What does that mean? Why is that significant?
I understand that. The voting disability immediately comes to mind.
Well, rolling by any other means.
But I'm not smelling so sweet.
You don't want us to write this son because the right to vote remains intact.
Yeah. No. Not the strongest, sir.
Yeah, okay.
The disabilities between an individual who's convicted of a crime and a juvenile who's adjudicated delinquent have become much more similar under this statutory provision. There's no argument there. The cases that discuss distinctions between criminal codes and juvenile justice codes have always made much of the fact that individuals who were adjudicated delinquent could go through life and say that they had not been convicted of a crime. In some instances, in terms of employment, that may be of significance. It may also have intangible significance to the individuals that are involved, and I would not attempt to weigh that.
I didn't look it up, and I know it was in the brief, but what is the use for that delinquency finding for if they testify later on as an adult? Is it any delinquency finding? Or?
I would have to go back and check. I imagine it would be certainly subject to any kind of relevancy objection that you can make.
The same
under,
as a criminal conviction.
Sure, and under 90403, a general objection.
So I'm just wondering if they are delinquent, other than that restriction, which is true for convictions also, if there was any other restriction.
I would close with one comment in an area that I didn't have much of a chance to touch on, and that's equal protection. If this court chooses to go forward in an equal protection analysis, then I think it must examine this statute under the rational basis test. And I think it passes muster under the rational basis test. The legislature could reasonably conclude that by eliminating the statutory right to a jury trial, it would reduce the amount of time between the initiation of delinquency proceedings by the filing of a petition and the dispositional hearing, where the judge has an opportunity to order services, order whatever is necessary in the individual case. Plainly, that is a legitimate state interest. Efficiency in processing the cases is a legitimate state interest. Getting an individual juvenile necessary treatment through a dispositional order is a legitimate state purpose. The method is rationally related to that purpose, as we argued on brief. Historically, legislation such as this has been reviewed under a rational basis analysis. There is no fundamental right at issue here. Fundamental right, and I am blanking on the second one. Membership in a suspect class. Thank you. Juveniles traditionally have not been held to be a suspect class for purposes of equal protection analysis. I'd prefer to take any remaining questions. And I will not look at my shoes anymore. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal by Ms. Parrish.
I just want to talk briefly, since we've gotten to equal protection, to go back to that for one moment. The equal protection analysis is that the state must have a reason to make the distinction between the various classes. And as Mr. Posner-Weber has pointed out, certainly there is a reason for the state to want effective, efficient systems to move children through this delinquency system as quickly as possible. So does the state want effective, efficient systems in Chapter 51 or Chapter 48, for example. In the mental commitment system, we provide a jury trial within 14 days of detention. And it's hard to argue that a juvenile delinquency proceeding needs less efficiency than that. The same obvious interests are in Chapter 48 proceedings where children are taken out of their homes as abused or neglected. Clearly, the state has expressed a very strong interest in quickly moving through those chapters, too. So there's no, we still have not heard anything, any speculation, any reason why a Chapter 938 proceeding needs more efficiency than a Chapter 51 or a Chapter 48 or a Chapter 980 proceeding. I just want to mention, too, with regard to the majority...
You don't think that the age of the individual, the involvement of the parents, the fact that the parents are involved much more, obviously at a younger age, than would give some rational basis for that determination?
A distinction between which categories are you saying?
Between the criminal and the juvenile code.
I think you could make that argument, but I'm saying even if you accept the state's argument that this is not like a criminal prosecution, what about Chapter 48, where you're dealing with children who are 12, 13, 14 years old being taken out of their homes on the basis of abuse or neglect? Don't we want that one to move very quickly, efficiently, and effectively as well? Or a mental commitment for a child is the same thing. Your parents are very involved in those. But again, they actually get jury trials within 14 days of detention. So I think that there's no reason to distinguish this case from a 51 or a 48 case. I just want to mention briefly the majority of the states, the argument about whether other states provide a jury trial in juvenile delinquency proceedings. Some of those cases were cited in the briefs, but I think one of the distinguishing characteristics is if you read those cases, they're struggling with does placement in a prison alone make this a criminal case? Does a three strikes offense make it a criminal case? The states that do not provide jury trials, if you look at that footnoted TM, almost every one of those decisions is from the 60s and the 70s. I have not read every one of them, but I feel quite confident that you will find a parens patriae intent and purpose in almost every one of those codes. That if you look at other states' holdings, they do not have the intent and purpose that the Wisconsin Juvenile Justice Code currently has. I also want to mention, we haven't really talked about 10-year-olds. But it's important to know that under this code, 10-year-olds can be held as serious juvenile offenders until age 25, and they can be held in adult prison as part of that commitment proceeding as serious juvenile offenders. And we need to think about the seriousness of that